This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by Cedarside. Cedarside's original 100% organic insect spray kills bed bugs, mosquitoes, fleas, ticks, mites, scorpions, roaches, and more, but is completely safe for your home, pets, and family. Go to cedarside.com, use coupon code Hoffman at checkout for free shipping, or call 800-842-1464 and mention you heard it here. Welcome to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and today we're going to talk about something very practical and germane to a problem which besets our country, threatens to virtually destroy our nation because our eating habits are abysmal. The SAD, or the Standard American Diet, has resulted in an epidemic of degenerative diseases. And, you know, we've taken all kinds of measures to address that. We know there's a problem. On a recent edition of Intelligent Medicine, I talked about an initiative in Los Angeles that was started, about 7 or 8 years ago, to ban fast food restaurants from the inner city, where inner city residents were binging on junk food, having lots of soda. They had unprecedented levels of obesity, diabetes, cardiovascular disease, degenerative disorders, and they thought that this would make a difference. Well, 7 years later, they reassessed the situation, and what they discovered is the ban had absolutely no impact on the rate of obesity and on the health of the inhabitants. Then there's school lunch programs, which are well-intentioned, and certainly kids should get better nutrition from school cafeterias, but it's the law of unintended consequences. Some of these meals are unpalatable for kids who are not used to eating that kind of food. Lots of it ends up in the garbage can, and they go across the street to the fast food eatery and tank up on junk food. And then there are proposals to tax or outright ban sugary or junk food. And while it's an appealing notion, studies have shown that would have a minimal impact on people's intake of these foods. Look what happens with cigarettes. Just as many people are smoking cigarettes. Prohibition, you saw how that worked out, in the 1920s. And so what's the alternative? Well, today we're going to talk to an individual who is doing something very constructive on this front. And I think it's a template for what we should be doing across the country to transform America. The program is called the Suppers Program. The Suppers Program. There's a website, the Suppers Programs, it's plural, .org, that describes it. And today we're going to talk to its founder, its originator, Dorothy Mullen. I know Dorothy for a long time because she has long been a citizen advocate on behalf of a natural approach to medicine. In fact, when I was a young physician, early in my career, there was an organization in New York called the Foundation for Advancement of Innovative Medicine, or FAME. That was an organization that sought to push back against laws which literally outlawed the practice of complementary medicine in New York. I mean, just for practicing alternative medicine, you could be prosecuted, delicensed, subject to professional discipline. And FAME fought successfully for laws to allow doctors to utilize nutrition, vitamins, IVs, and natural therapies in their practice. And the rest is history. And Dorothy Mullen was at the forefront of that effort. She was president of FAME, and she was an enthusiastic supporter of natural medicine. Now she's branched out, and she has originated the Suppers Program, which we're going to talk about. So, Dorothy, it's a pleasure having you here on Intelligent Medicine, and nice to talk to you after all these years.
After all these years, yes. Thank you for the opportunity to talk about my favorite subject.
Well, indeed, because you're all fired up about it. Tell us a little bit about the Suppers Program. What is it?
So it's a network now in New Jersey of programs that are nearly free to users. People just cover the cost of being there. And we serve people who have to make diet and lifestyle changes for either health, mental health, or also addiction reasons. And it's really pretty simple. It's elegantly simple, but people find it hard to believe that we have these transformations. Here's all we do. we cook together from scratch. No processed foods, no gluten, no sugar, very limited dairy. So we cook together, we eat together, we run food experiments, which from your listeners' point of view probably sounds like elimination diets. And then we have these educational experiences related to the particular diagnoses of the people who attend the meetings. So the meetings are autonomous. We have meetings for people with type 1 and type 2 diabetes, separate meetings for people with celiac disease and digestive disorders, people with autoimmune dysfunctions. Suppers also runs meetings for mothers that are more concerned about the prevention end of things, so you don't have to have serious pathology already, but if you want to learn how to prepare food so that your children don't go down that route, or so that you can bring back a spouse who's, you know, putting it on around the middle and the diabetes numbers are starting to be threatening, there's a prevention orientation to it. And then we also run suppers for sobriety for people who are experiencing what I am going to call outrageously uncomfortable sobriety because they're trying to do sobriety without good nutrition.
Well, yeah, that's a very important point, and we'll get into it, is the proper accompaniment to sobriety, because I remember, I've never been an alcoholic, but during medical school, one of our field trips, it was sort of a field trip. They said, look, we want you to get acquainted with, addiction and some of the resources that are out there. So they encouraged us to attend an AA meeting, and we were invited as observers. And I walked into the AA meeting, and they had big coffee urns there. And they also had a big, big, huge, piled high plate of donuts.
Right.
And already I was nutritionally conscious, and the room was full of smoke because right. People were huffing and puffing on their cigarettes. Hey, but at least they weren't, knocking back, a pint of Jack Daniels. Okay, so that's progress. But
that's what we call, yeah.
So, I mean, you're very familiar with this paradigm because you've worked a lot in the addiction field. But unfortunately, what happens is these people are doing some things that pretty seriously undermine their health and their moods, and even jeopardize their sobriety by following that kind of lifestyle.
Yes, absolutely. And one of the reasons for that is that back in the 1930s and 40s, when AA was just getting going, the original members, hey, if we give this guy a piece of chocolate cake and a cup of coffee, he's going to be a lot more likely to maintain his sobriety. Of course, back then, they didn't know, sugar operates on the same pathways as cocaine, and wheat and dairy products are like baby morphine. I mean, they just didn't know that they were dealing with receptor sites and how they were dealing with receptor sites that engage the pleasure cascade. So back then in the 40s, okay, we can understand why we encouraged our alcoholics in recovery to have these things, because it was one step better. I mean, it was clearly better than being an active alcoholic. The problem with it is that it keeps people in the addictive cycle of craving because they're not dealing with their brain's needs for good fats and, their neurotransmitters' needs for proper amino acids. It just solved the immediate problem but kept the cravings alive over time. And we still very much to this day allow coffee drinking and cookie eating and so forth without any recognition that these things keep the cravings for the sugars alive, which also supports the cravings for alcohol.
Well, you speak to this, not necessarily, I don't know whether you've had experience with personal addictions or if you want to talk about that, but you've had a personal transformation through natural medicine. You were not my patient, but you worked with integrative doctors in the 1970s, perhaps the 1980s, at a time where you were experiencing a lot of stress and a lot of issues, health issues. And does this effort to underwrite the Suppers program spring from your own personal experience?
Well, yes. In that regard, I'm very average. I had a traumatic experience, and I did not want to become angry, defensive, infuriated at the medical community. I wanted to do something about it. But yes, I did start with, panic attacks and phenobarbital and digestive problems when I was 15 years old, and I, you know, the doctor didn't know what to do with me. And it was probably another 35 years going through my own addictions, my own mental health issues, my own, you know, a month in a psychiatric hospital, all kinds of constant respiratory infections until I was nearly 50 years old and found out that the whole thing started with every single chewing surface in my mouth was prophylactically filled with a shallow, broad mercury amalgam filling that then just released, as you, I'm sure you've talked about this many times, all kinds of vapors into me over the years of chewing. And by the time I finally got to a doctor, I was so mercury toxic that I was having very serious health and mental health and addictions problems, all related to the mercury. But when I was doing alternative medicine, they were only just beginning to test people for mercury poisoning.
But in addition, you were on sort of an indiscriminate diet. You had no notion of the therapeutic benefits of blood sugar stabilization, of avoidance of food allergies, of you know, proper you know, omega-3 fatty acid consumption, and on and on and on. At this point, you follow a stringent diet and you take supplements.
So, yes, and I never recommend a specific diet. I always tell people to do their experiments, but for me, the life-changing moment was getting fairly strict about paleo. It's not something with my environmental conscience that I really want to do, is that meat eating, but my biology has sort of trumped my value system and determined that I'm going to eat a lot of vegetables, almost no grains, legumes, and seeds, and flesh, because that's how I avoid now. You know, I used to be a universal allergy reactor. I would probably still test that way. But if I'm fairly strict on this way of eating, I have boundless energy where I'm younger at 60 than I was
yep.
at 30.
Oh, you are.
Basically the message.
You really are a dynamo, because what you put together with the Supper's program obviously takes tremendous amount of energy and dedication. And I recently saw you at a medical conference, and I must say, you look marvelous, darling. You look great. I mean, you look fantastic. Forget 60. You know, for 48, you know, you look great. So you're actually, I think, a living testimony to the benefits of this type of program. But as you say, it's not a one-size-fits-all, and your program is very experiential. You want people to experience a change, find a pathway for themselves. Maybe it's not as stringent a pathway as yours. Maybe it's, you know, just elimination of junk and a more overall healthy diet, or this investigation might lead people to make more drastic changes. So in your at your website, thesuppersprograms.org, which I recommend that people take a look at, you have a bunch of resources, and one of the most fascinating resources there is what you call the beginner's questionnaire. And could you take us through that? Because that's actually a good entry point for someone who's saying, gee, you know, am I a candidate for this type of program? Would I be a beneficiary of this type of change? And so take us through that beginner's questionnaire.
Okay. So the beginner's questionnaire started with the assumption, and you will recognize this name because we're old enough, but Carl Pfeiffer wrote some things about blood sugar long before most anybody else was writing about it. And one of the things that he said is that you could explain all kinds of other chronic illnesses, that there was a biological underpinning that was common to blood sugar problems, alcoholism, depression, anxiety, what we now call learning issues, and that if you could teach people to eat and supplement in order to stabilize their blood sugar and their mood chemistry, you would probably find the way of eating that would deal with a lot of the other issues that extend from what we now call blood sugar and mood chemistry issues. And of course, how many years ago, four decades ago, maybe he was writing, and of course, it's all turned out to be absolutely true that central to these chronic degenerative processes is often a problem with blood sugar and mood chemistry.
And indeed, so he was a New Jersey doctor. That's sort of the hotbed of where the Supper's program developed, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes, I don't know. He must still be floating around in the air around Princeton or something.
Right.
Because I found him highly inspirational at the time that I was working on the program design, even though at that point he was deceased, but his work was brilliant and lives on and has been very durable. So this beginning questionnaire is designed to help people figure out if their health problems and their mood chemistry problems relate to their relationship with food. And by the end of this, you know, these 10 or 15 questions, you will have a sense if you're a member of this family that includes depression, anxiety, learning issues, obesity, diabetes, and problems with alcohol. And the more you try to resolve your issues, or the more you experience relief by eating and drinking, the more likely it is that your problems with diabetes, depression, etc., relate to your relationship with a processed food supply.
Right. So what we... This actually, it's interesting, it's sort of an extension of the addiction model, because actually, you know, we tend to think the big problems in America are diabetes, cancer, heart disease, but at the root of many of these problems is a deep-seated addiction to the wrong kind of food, and that's also why people are so unsuccessful at modifying their diets. I mean, we can give people diet sheets. I can hand out the salad and salmon diet, even post it on my website till the cows come home, but it's difficult for people to implement. You know, they get on the wagon, they fall off the wagon, and, you know, it's a merry-go-round. The diet Absolutely. Industry makes billions, a multi-billion dollar industry. People shed millions of pounds every year and then regain them.
Right. And, of course, it's in the interest of the food processors to not have us know that these foods are inherently addictive, because then they can say things like, it's up to the parents to control everything in moderation. You know, it's you just have to exercise portion control. I think that portion control is absolutely a cruel concept, because it's like waving a glass of bourbon under the nose of a recovering alcoholic,
right.
saying, well, you can just exercise portion control, you know, just have one drink. But some of these processed foods are so inherently addictive, and so particularly addictive for some individuals, that there is not enough willpower in the universe for these people to do it on portion control or willpower alone. Some people absolutely must 100% assiduously totally avoid certain trigger foods, while others can enjoy them as treats because they're not triggers, they're simply treats.
Exactly.
But you have to do these experiments to find out who you are.
And another cruel hoax, and this has been perpetrated by the food industry, they say, you heard this refrain again and again, which is that, little ice cream, a little bit of, you know, some Coke, Cola, Reese's Cups, they can all be part of a healthy diet as long
right.
as you exercise, as if, you know, we can simply expiate our dietary indiscretions by burning off the calories. And for some people, that is a cruel hoax, because the intake of these foods can in no way be mitigated by even enormous amounts of exercise.
Right. And the problem is, it keeps the craving alive. If you get the small exposure, it's like the first drink for an alcoholic. So they're really doomed until there is a culture-wide understanding that these foods are addictive for some people. I don't really see any hope for turning around the epidemic of chronic illnesses, because don't they just about all rely on relationships with processed foods?
Yeah, right. So instead of having the regular ice cream, have a low calorie ice cream, or like count the calories on the bread loaf that you buy, and doesn't work.
Right, it doesn't work, and especially when you start talking about things that taste sweet but then are non-caloric.
Oh boy.
Well, if you trick your brain into thinking that it needs to produce insulin, and you do produce insulin because your brain has been tricked, then what happens? Then you might be getting a hypoglycemic response while consuming what you think is going to be doing you a favor. So the whole thing is just, it's a very big problem.
Yes, it is. It's a huge problem.
It's a very big problem.
Also, you have a series of white papers Which include one that I found really interesting, which is that the title of it is How You Feel Is Data. Well, explain that. How you feel is data. I mean, if I feel really depressed, I mean, maybe it's real. Maybe the world really does suck. And, you know, you just turn on, you know, cable news or, you know, you got to face a particularly gloomy day. I mean, come on. How is how you feel data?
Well, I think the need for this, how you feel is data, it's actually a series of charts, helps people reconnect to their bodies. And addictions and a lot of these chronic illnesses are nothing if not manifestations of our disconnections from our own body wisdom, our own ability to interpret our feelings, and especially to look at our attitudes, our thought patterns, and our emotions, to plumb them for the data about the quality of our food. I mean, if you think about when people are triggered to eat something that they know they shouldn't have, that they would be better off not having, but they eat anyway, well, for one thing, that defines what an addiction is, when you continue to do a behavior over and over, even while you know that it's harming you. So if you have some combination of mood swings, inability to sit still and learn and concentrate in children, you know, poor concentration in adults, impulse control problems, all of these things that come with very specific physical signatures. They all can be described in terms of how your body feels. If you can associate them with relief on eating something, then that is really important data. Does it jazz me up? Does it energize me? Does it calm me down? Do I feel more serene when I eat this or drink that? If I have a craving for something or a desire to consume something and it rapidly changes how you feel, then the data that you're getting from your body is that you have an addictive relationship with whatever fixed your problem. And the faster the Coca-Cola or the pile of pasta or the Snicker bars work to change how you feel, the stronger the likelihood is that your whatever it is, addiction, chronic degenerative process, type 2 diabetes, is being driven by this relationship.
So in a way, your thoughts and your emotions, I mean, while real at some level, they may just be physiological manifestations of, say, a dip in blood sugar or an essential fatty acid imbalance or a lack of magnesium or B vitamins.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and another big one is dehydration. I mean,
yes.
a lot of the same things that you would feel if you have low blood sugar are the same things that you get a little fuzzy thinking. You know, your body starts looking for something to eat or drink. It can't really decide, am I hungry or thirsty?
Yeah.
Most people don't go for water.
I literally had that experience the other day because I had a day off and I went to the new Whitney Museum in New York, which is a big, beautiful new museum by the water next to the Hudson. And it's so I had a big breakfast and, you know, I set out and I was just fascinated. I just went from gallery to gallery to gallery there. And you did a lot of walking, and I looked at my iPhone, and I had already done 10,000 steps. And then I said, I think I need to do some little more shopping, have some more time. And suddenly, as I was walking down the street, I just felt like, oh God, I just felt so depleted and depressed. I mean, I had sort of a brain lock. And then it occurred to me that I looked at my watch, and I hadn't eaten for about 6.5 hours. And I thought, wow. I think I really need to check into the nearby a Turkish restaurant and have some lamb and rice in a salad. And
right.
After that, I was reconstituted. I was also dehydrated too because in a museum sometimes you're walking around you don't drink that much, especially women don't
right.
because they don't want to use a public restroom. Yeah,
right.
So that's
so
a specific example.
Perfect example. That's a perfect example. And we get, and I'm sorry, but it's particularly women who get the problem combines with our hormones. And there are so many times when we are completely misdiagnosed. In my mind, you can't, and my degree is addictions counseling, so I deal with people in the mental health field. You cannot separate a person's mental health status from their eating habits. You can't for sure say the depression, the anxiety, the learning issues, the mood swings, the poor concentration are not driven by food if a person is eating a lot of processed foods, because whether it's 10% or 80%, it is going to have an effect on people's perception of their spouse's intelligence, you know, their boss's competence. It's going to affect, because when your brain is out of fuel, which is what you experience when you had that low blood sugar moment after, you know, being in the museum for 7 hours without eating, when your brain is out of fuel, everything looks like a brain symptom, right? Glucose is the preferred fuel for the brain. So if it's low, you're going to see mood swing problems. You're going to see concentration problems. You're going to see impulse control problems, because your body wants nothing. Nothing is more important than, you know, getting some sugar in there, some carb in there, if that's the problem, or drinking water if that's the problem. Your data again. Your brain will scream with very loud but inarticulate signals that it's not getting its needs met. So what the SUPPORT program seeks to do is to give people the language of their physical body so that they can feel these uncomfortable feelings, emotions, impulse control problems, and recognize them not as being weak-willed or having some other, you know, or having a stupid boss or stupid spouse, but rather as an indication of the quality of their food.
Well, that's it. You really articulated it beautifully. And this is a good point at which to pause, because we've introduced the concept behind the SUPPORT programs. TheSUPPORTsPrograms.org is the website. And when we return in part two, we divide these podcasts into two parts. I'd like to get into the particulars. What does it entail? What does it involve? What are these get-togethers and meetings like, and who can access them? Our guest is Dorothy Mullen, the originator of the SUPPORT programs in New Jersey, and soon to be in other regions of the country, hopefully. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is Intelligent Medicine.